You're listening to the Physio Matters podcast in association with Choose Health, and this is Session 8. Welcome back to the Physio Matters podcast with me, Jack Chew. As each episode rolls out, we get an influx of new listeners and generally an influx of new feedback, so thanks on both counts. Session 7 was with Adam Meekins, who's known to be Mr. Controversial, and it was great for the podcast to almost out Adam as a very real human being. Now, talking of controversy, today's interviewee is Alan Taylor, who's a passionate and often outspoken physio, academic and lecturer. He specialises in today's topic, which is hemodynamics and the vascular system. Now, I love it when episodes flow into the next one. And in today's session 8, I chat to the man who recently provoked accusations of trolling from the Noi Group. And today's interview predates all the recent blog drama that I'm sure will soon be known as Whiplash Cancergate, so it doesn't come up in conversation at all during our chat. Maybe after listening to the podcast, you might be able to recognise the reason for Alan's maybe frustration with the very trendy neurological bias that we sometimes see in modern practice. So have a listen and see what you think. I hope today's podcast into something relatively new and relatively different of hemodynamics will add another string to your clinical reasoning bow. Enjoy. Hi, Alan. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, Jack. Yeah, my name's Alan Taylor. I'm a physiotherapist, primarily a clinician. I also work at the University of Nottingham as a sort of academic and lecturer. I'm involved in writing a few papers and book chapters, and well, that's enough, isn't it, for a start?
Okay, so that'll do for now. And what led to an interest, because you're maybe best known for your work in and around hemodynamics and some cervical arterial dysfunction work, what led to that?
Okay, briefly, my background is probably in sports medicine, and actually what happened, this was purely by chance or serendipity, where what happened was a patient walked through the door, and I think we can learn a lot from patients in many ways, and what happened was a patient walked through the door who was frankly quite a puzzle to me in the clinic, who I couldn't really get to grips with quite what was happening, and it wasn't in my sort of textbook thinking about, you know, with regard to what was happening with this patient. He came in with, to cut a long story short, with what looked like some ridiculous symptoms from the lumbar spine. He told me he'd got a trapped nerve, but he's had too many things didn't fit, basically. And at the end of the day, I thought around this and decided I need to look at some other systems. It was a slightly longer process, a more detailed process than that. But at the end of the day, we thought we might be missing something. And at the end of the day, I was drawn towards the vascular system. And it turned out this guy had got this really quite advanced vascular problem. He was only in his 30s and he was an elite athlete, which is the link to the sport. This guy, frankly, been through a whole host of other interventions and assessments, where he'd been seen by consultants in various disciplines, he'd been seen by physiotherapists, osteopaths, the usual route where someone's trawling around trying to find out what's wrong with them. And I guess we may have dropped lucky, or, you know, sometimes we like to think we're wizards in these areas. But no, we looked at the vascular system, and by doing some simple vascular assessment, this guy was routed through eventually to vascular surgery, where he had to have an operation which was the actual cure for his problem, rather than the previous core stability work that he'd been doing.
Okay, so that was something you stumbled across almost by accident?
Entirely.
Yeah, right. And so you decided then to not just take that as a one-off case study, pursue that and pursue even research in that area?
Yeah, so obviously that sparked off an interest in the topic, and I at that stage started to look through the literature, as you do, to see if this was a one-off or whether there was more of it around. And it turns out that since around 1984, there have been a number of papers, mainly in mainland Europe, coming out of France and Northern Europe, which related to some problems in athletes, in young athletes, some vascular problems in young athletes. And this was a topic called endofibrosis, which was affecting the external iliac artery. And at that point, I had to go to the anatomy book and remind myself where the external iliac artery was. But we, as we looked, found more and more, and then eventually I was in the middle of doing a master's study at the time, and I decided to do some a little research project on some athletes that were suffering exercise induced pain who'd been through similar processes. They'd been seen by therapists and orthopedic specialists and others. They'd been offered various remedies, including potential surgeries. Some had even had surgeries, so some had gone as far as having sort of fasciotomies and things like that, right, which had been unsuccessful. And we did a study on a series of these guys, and found out that there was kind of more to it than met the eye. So that study got published in Medicine, Science, Sports and Exercise. And the co-author on that was a guy called Keith George from Liverpool, John Moores.
Right.
Who's pretty well up in this area. So we've continued, and it became a bit of a sort of route around the body. So we started there and thought, well, you know, does it end there? And the more we looked and searched, we found there was lots of things that maybe we'd been missing. And the key thing, I think, for me, as a physiotherapist, was that all of these patients that we were discovering in different ways were reporting pain syndromes.
Yeah.
So they were coming into a physiotherapy clinic and saying, well, I've got some kind of weird pain syndrome, which was frankly probably not fitting the normal neuromusculoskeletal patterns. And there were some subtle clues there. And the more we saw, the more we read, the more we encountered people with these problems, we realized that maybe we as therapists, and then also some of the literature was suggesting also that the doctors, the specialists, the sports medicine people needed to be much more aware of this, because even though it was rare, it is rare, it does exist out there in a population, and there are ways maybe to identify these kinds of patients. So if we take it down the route, we'd be going down to the popliteal fossa, where we see some other anomalies that may give rise to pain below the knee and into the foot region, and other symptoms as well. And then if we take that up to the upper limb, we can see some upper limb things. And then, of course, if you then start to take it to the other part that was kind of missing at that point, we've got the vascular system to the neck and head, and that's eventually where we ended up at the end of this trail, looking at the way we were thinking about, at that time, vertebrobasilar insufficiency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which the vernacular is probably changing more towards cervical arterial dysfunction now, hopefully.
Yeah, and for replacement of the acronym. But you almost inevitably you were going to then lead to neck interest, because we've got some pretty important arteries and vascular system factors up there. And not just, though, in cervical arterial dysfunction. There's some links, obviously, to the most common MSK presentation of whiplash-associated disorders, which can correlate sometimes to arterial problems.
I guess when we think about whiplash associated disorder, we think about a trauma, and what we found on that trip around the body, I guess, was that we found that arteries, which are frankly soft tissues, could be traumatized like any of the other soft tissues, but there's a kind of different mechanism taking place. And so as we looked through the literature, we were finding cases, like within sports medicine, we were finding cases of people who'd ended up injuring their internal carotid artery, for example, or external carotid artery. So it was kind of new information to us. And again, most of these people were presenting with pain. And that was one of the key presenting features. But there was some sort of special elements to it. That made you think about the vascular system, and that related to anything from external iliac artery through to popliteal, through to maybe subclavian, through to carotid artery or maybe even vertebral artery.
Right, so investigating those things was a direction that was taken, but there was an influx of sort of case study data in and around sort of the neck and VBI, as you first said, and it did lead to a bit of an industry-wide worry regarding assessment and treatment of the neck. Was that something that was unjust? Have we moved on from that, or was it a timely reminder of being safe with practice?
The thing that I forgot to mention is part of my remit is also to work as in the capacity of an expert witness, and I guess I get to see the other side of the coin slightly with regard to that sort of risk assessment thing. So, sure, there were masses of cases, and I don't think we should ever get carried away just by case series or anything like that. But at the end of the day, I think what happens with case studies and case series is that they often lead to sort of larger studies, etc., etc. We may even end up with RCTs, whatever that may be. And I think that's kind of how embryonic research is. And so I think we mustn't dismiss case studies, because frankly they do exist, and you know, we can learn from them, and sometimes that takes us down another route. So in terms of should we really be worried, I went through myself a sort of educational process where I learned all about this, and I thought, oh blimey, maybe we should be worried, because it seemed like I'm reading lots about it, there must be lots of it. But at the end of the day, I think now I've sort of come out the other side of that, and in actual fact both I and Roger, I think, would say that these cases are frankly very, very rare. But at the end of the day, though, the other side of the coin, in terms of risk assessment, again, with any risk assessment, whether you're doing a risk assessment of an office or a risk assessment of a patient, it's about how often you might encounter the risk, but then it's also about how severe that risk might be.
Yeah.
So if the severity of the risk is death or disability, but it might not happen very often, it's still quite high in terms of the risk assessment. Okay, so I think there's an understanding that these vascular problems, you know, dissection of arteries or the sequelae of that, which would be stroke, in certainly in a medico-legal environment, they're pretty rare. But there are often warning signs for therapists in all of these areas, all around the body, that there could be something vascular going on. And I think we should be listening out and should be aware of those warning signs, and I think it's something that should be in our education, frankly. And Jeremy Lewis, the great shoulder specialist, did come to one of myself and Roger's courses a few years ago, and he sort of sat back at the end of that and he said, well, pretty much every physiotherapist should know about this, because I know it's rare, but I need to know about it.
Yeah, and when it does happen, as you said, the consequences are much greater than other pathologies.
Well, I think Jeremy described a really interesting case study himself, because we always ask the question when we talk about the lumbar spine, well, has anybody in the room ever seen an abdominal aortic aneurysm? And Jeremy's hand went up at the back, and we went, oh, great, you know, tell us the story, Jeremy. And he said, well, I was going through this assessment of this guy. He was in his 60s, and we'd gone through all the subjective and the objective and everything. No, I was halfway through the objective, actually. He said, I got to the point, was about to do the straight leg raise, and I picked the guy's leg up, and I started to explain to him what I was going to do, and I was beginning to lift the leg. And then as I was looking at him and explaining what everything that was happening, I just looked at his abdomen, and I saw this sort of pulsing, sort of almost alien-like thing in his stomach, and I'd lowered his leg very steadily, and I sort of gathered my thoughts, and pretty much this guy ended up down in accident and emergency, having a surgery within hours of that assessment. And that brought it home to us, and it certainly brought it home to Jeremy in that particular case. And again, rare, but there would have been clues in that subjective history that he was taking earlier on, maybe if he'd been a little bit more aware of that at the time. And to be frank, it's not been part of our education as physical therapists.
No, that is a gap. And without going too much into the CAD stuff, too much in terms of clues and symptoms, because I know Roger, your partner in crime, did a podcast recently that we can refer to. But you've mentioned a few things and a few clues that will be worth us talking about. So what would there be the most straightforward clues that we should be more mindful of in a general assessment of any body part?
I think it's very much The new IFOMT guidance, it's not guidance, it's a framework for clinical reasoning, actually, is what they describe it as. And I think that's a really nice way for us to think about things. I think when you get guidelines and guidance, it makes people, you know, sort of think, oh, you know, how does this work? But I think a framework for thinking about a problem is actually a lot more healthy in terms of looking at it. So in terms, if what's kind of happened is that as a result of the challenge to how we were thinking, so what happened in essence was that I and Roger probably challenge the way we were thinking about the VBI problem as it was then, because we seemed to be just thinking about one artery and we weren't thinking about the system and we weren't thinking about all the different mechanisms that could take place. And I think IFOMT and the MACP and then all of the other manipulative therapy folks all around the world, in actual fact, sort of came up with this sort of consensus document, which was difficult to do, but they've done it and it was a huge success, but it's quite lengthy. And I think for clinicians at the end of the day, all people are saying is probably just think about the problem in a different way. Remember that the vertebral artery is one part of the system. Remember we've got carotid arteries as well. They provide 80% of the blood flow to the brain, and frankly that's often where people do, who suffer strokes and young strokes, that's often the origin of them.
Yeah.
And then of course you've got the circle of Willis, you've got the whole system, et cetera, but this is about thinking about cardiovascular at the end of the day, not just the neck and head. So often what we've got is subtle clues in the subjective history, which might be leading to think, well, is there something that makes me suspect this person could possibly be at risk of a vascular problem? So, you know, maybe it's a family history or a self history of some kind of cardiovascular thing. Maybe they've already had a heart disease problem. Maybe they've had a bypass surgery. Maybe they've got high cholesterol. Maybe they're on tablets for blood pressure, those sorts of things. And all the time then you've got this thing in your, what I call your back pocket, where you're thinking, well, there may be a little bit of a risk, so I might be thinking about this. And then the other element of that, and I've just mentioned it, is the blood pressure part. And we've been big advocates for a number of years that physiotherapists should be taking blood pressure, probably for a number of reasons, and not least because we ought to be involved in sort of exercise prescription as professionals for many of the sort of things that we're being faced by now, from the obesity epidemic through to maybe treatment methods for people with, you know, different pain syndromes all around the body. So if we're going to be exercise prescribing exercises, then really what we ought to be doing is maybe having some considerations of if these people are fit for exercise in the first place. Right. And blood pressure is an obvious place to kind of start.
Yeah.
So part of our recommendation was that physiotherapists, certainly where they think there is risk when it comes to maybe cervical spine, might be wanting to use blood pressure as one of their objective measures. And what's really nice about IFOMT is that what they've said is that therapists should have the ability to modify their assessment according to what they're hearing in that subjective assessment. And that, what that kind of means is that if someone's coming in and all these sort of flags are waving at you and you're thinking, well, actually, each question I ask about the vascular is kind of going up and up and up, and I've got an increasing suspicion or index of suspicion of a potential vascular problem, then maybe instead of going on to range of motion for this patient, maybe I'll do something a bit more benign, like a blood pressure measurement. And frankly, I learned the hard way probably at the end of the day, because I had an interesting case of a lady with whiplash, which has been written up in manual therapy now, who came in saying she'd had this whiplash injury 3 weeks ago. She was telling me all the story about the pain, but the pain wasn't the biggest problem. In her description, she said, but I think my blood pressure's a bit high. And she probably said that to me around five times.
Right.
A couple of times on the phone during the organising the appointment, and then a number of times during the actual consultation. And it wasn't until I was puzzling over some of the things she was telling me, including the fact that she was struggling to swallow a little bit, and she kept gagging on her food, and then a couple of other bits and pieces. And then eventually I did the observation thing that I should have been doing a little bit earlier on, right. And I noticed this sort of pulsing carotid artery in the front of her neck. And then finally, the final clue for me that meant that I couldn't really fail to act properly was she said, you know what? Sometimes I feel like a ticking time bomb waiting to go off. And at that wow. point, I thought, shall I do my usual assessment or shall I kind of do what she'd been giving me clues about the whole time?
Yeah.
And of course, I got the blood pressure monitor. We took the blood pressure, and the blood pressure was sky high. It was 210 over 130 or something like that. And she really didn't ought to have been in my physiotherapy clinic, and we sent her off and she was dealt with in a different way.
Yeah.
This was not somebody that we needed to be doing range of motion assessment with or anything else in a manual way. This was somebody who didn't ought to be in a physiotherapy clinic. Probably she needed to be an accident emergency, to be fair.
But for clinicians, they don't have to wait for that experience themselves. They can learn from the experience of others and not have quite the seriousness in front of them.
I think that's the message. I think, you know, I guess, as I've said, we probably learned the hard way, or I don't know whether that was the easy way. She was giving me clues all the way. It was eventually she got me to listen, you know, and I think, you know, we have to listen to our patients. Yeah. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that's the thrust of the papers that we've written over the years, is that I guess we've been trying to disseminate that information and say that very, very rarely you will have a patient who comes in who is really not appropriate for you to be going ahead in the usual ways, how I'll describe it. So, you know, and this is the nice thing about the IFOMP guidance. It talks about modifying your assessment according to what you've been listening to or hearing.
So another time, Alan, I'm sure we'll get a chance to talk more about whiplash, which is another area I know you've been published in. But if we talk about sort of differential diagnosis in and around the neck and vascular system, what common masqueraders, both mechanical and non-mechanical, do we need to be mindful of?
Well, I think if we refer back to that IFOMP document again, we're not just thinking about the cervical arterial dysfunction element. We also may, wherever there's been a trauma, have a consideration, certainly in the cervical spine, of potential instability. And again, that's very rare, but it often comes with a few subjective indicators. Patients will be commonly suggesting that their head feels particularly heavy. They may be very, very nervous of movement. They may be describing clicking or crunching or cracking during movement. And they may actually have some unusual signs and symptoms that may or may not be linked to cranial nerves if they're implicated in the problem. And of course, if someone's got an instability, then that might link to some sort of cervical arterial dysfunction related probably to a mechanism linked to the vertebral artery in this case.
Right.
So it can be a sort of hodgepodge of symptoms. But one of the things that's often very clear is that these patients don't seem to be either presenting or responding to therapies in the usual way. So they're the sorts of patients that will come back to you after you've done something very normal and say, oh, that was really weird what you did last time, and I felt really strange after it. And they're reporting some odd symptoms which are not the usual response to something very, very straightforward that you usually see day to day.
And on a suspicion of, say, upper cervical instability, what would then we need, or what could we go forward and do objectively to sort of think whether that needs acting on?
Well, it may be that, again, you have to adjust your assessment so that, in actual fact, you don't go forward objectively, because some of the cases that we've seen, and again, you're looking at case study material and sometimes anecdotal material, but some of the cases we've both seen written and heard about might relate to the most serious cervical instability, which is a odontoid peg fracture, and sometimes they present in a way that the patient comes in terrified of movement, quite naturally, because the body's sensing something clearly, you know, catastrophic has potentially happened, or might happen, and as a result, the body's implemented this incredible muscle spasm around the cervical spine. So, in actual fact, to try and go through an objective assessment may not be appropriate here, because the muscle spasm would render most of those instability tests null and void, because the muscle spasm will be trying to hold the head onto the neck in the presence of a fracture. And these patients just maybe won't even let you attempt to do it if that was your choice. But I think maybe you should be looking at these people and thinking, well, this is really strange. Maybe I, again, ought to be adjusting what I'm doing here. And if there's a suspicion from the history of the trauma, this incredible muscle spasm that's demonstrated, and any other symptoms of anxiety or anything else that you might see with these patients, it might be wise that you're sort of sending them back to the GP, asking for the relevant views. And of course, the one that's sometimes misses the open mouth view on the x-ray, and sometimes people have had just standard AP and laterals without the open mouth view, and again an odontoid peg fracture can be missed in these cases. And that's the value of case studies, because what happens in a well-written case study is that you end up seeing, oh right, we got the x-rays back and it seemed fine, but something still wasn't right, and eventually the patient went back and had a third x-ray or second x-ray with the correct view, and that's when the thing was revealed.
Right.
And I think, you know, these are things that clinicians clinicians ought to be aware of, and generally are.
Yeah, because people aren't routinely imaged following a whiplash on average. So would you say, how do we know when to escalate that appropriately? Is there any subjective clues if we were going to avoid objective?
I think it's really just that unusual presentation and
clinical hunch.
And yeah, I was about to say that. Sometimes it's just that gut feeling that something's not quite right. And frankly, you do have to go with your gut feeling sometimes. And it's no good writing a really wishy-washy letter to the GP. You really need to give them some sort of objective stuff to work with. Otherwise, they won't act either.
Yeah.
I think we as therapists need to be better at communicating sometimes. And if we're able to communicate with the history of the trauma, there may be some objective findings. I'll come to those in a second, but certainly communicate. One of the objective findings is this almost wooden-like muscle spasm that you see with these cases, which won't allow examination anyway. And then maybe the fear and the anxiety, or the fact that the patient's perhaps holding their head on, which is occasionally described.
Yeah.
And it should be a bit of a giveaway clue that something's not quite right. And there are some unusual other things that are described, such as tingling, pins and needles around the face, the jaw, and occasionally a metallic taste in the mouth. And nobody but no one has been able to explain why that occurs. And it occurs in a number of cases. It sometimes occurs prior to stroke. Mm-hmm. Again, that's anecdotal, but it's written quite a lot in the literature, and we don't know why that occurs, and we'd love someone to tell us.
No, well, we'll look forward to that one day. But then if we think that someone describing those altered sensation in and around the face or strange symptoms up there, we would then hopefully would indicate some cranial nerve testing. And so where are we in terms of both literature and experience with that?
Certainly. The things I talked about earlier with my blood pressure description, and maybe, as you've just said, someone with tingling, pins and needles around the face, or any other unusual symptoms. And sometimes a thing that you might be looking for is something like facial asymmetry after a trauma, because that would link in with this cranial nerve assessment. Where are we with it, Jack? Well, frankly, unless you were trained really, really recently, it's most likely that as a physical therapist, you probably... You might have heard of the cranial nerves, but you probably weren't trained necessarily how to do them. And you may not have been trained how to use them in context with the things that we see in the clinic. Because frankly, if we ask physiotherapists, would they do a neurological assessment in the lower limb and the upper limb if they thought it was appropriate, they all say yes. And if we say, well, okay, when we get to the head and neck, do you do a full neurological assessment? They look at us slightly gone out. We say, well, we mean cranial nerve testing. And they go, oh, well, and it's a little bit of a... Some do, but on average, if we're talking to a sort of a big room of folks, the majority don't. So there's a sort of creeping awareness of this, and that links in with things like the IFOMP document.
Mm-hmm.
But in actual fact, it's not our fault, I don't think, as therapists. I think, frankly, just the educational system didn't prepare us for it, which is kind of strange there when you think about it, because we were prepared for the lower limb, we were prepared for the upper limb, but now here we are in the most dangerous area of the body in terms of risk. You know, get it wrong and it's stroke or death. You know, get something wrong in other areas and it's probably a little less serious. And yet we weren't using the tools that we could have been to make this assessment. So, and what's strange is we kind of knew about this because previously with things like the previous guidelines that were looking at risk assessment of the neck that were coming out of Australia, etc., they were asking us to ask about the dizziness, dysarthria, dysphagia, those sorts of things, and then think about numbness and nystagmus and things like that. But then not actually to perform the tests that would truly look for those things, and what they are the cranial nerve tests at the end of the day.
So upskilling this area involves more than just reading around it. It also means getting stuck in and practicing and also understanding the context of what you're testing.
Sure, I think therapists that weren't schooled in that just need to go. There's lots of resource on the internet, or maybe go and sit in with a GP they've got a good friendly relationship with, or a neurologist who will be doing this on a regular basis and see how it's done. And it is done in, a whole series of different ways, and you know, you'll see different people doing different things for each of the tests, but they all allude to the same thing, and you know, there's just different ways of skinning a cat at the end of the day. But I think resources on YouTube, going in and working with some other clinicians and just getting a feel for why it's done and how it's done and how it might relate to your practice. But the nice thing about it is then, rather than sending the letter that I referred to of referral earlier on, where you say, well, I suspect this patient might have this or that because of this or that, you can say, well, I suspect all of those things, but then also we've done some objective testing and we've found, you know, a dysfunction with cranial nerve, whatever it might be. And then the GP is almost obliged to say, oh, well, I better just run through those cranial nerves again, and then they'll probably find a similar thing. And then there's more likelihood that the patients get referred on for appropriate tests. And if that was an X-ray and positional X-rays, if you're looking for instability, so flexion and extension X-rays, or open mouth X-rays if you're looking for an odontoid peg fracture, you know, then you know you stand a better chance that the other clinicians are going to be paying attention to your good referral.
Okay, that's great. And that's instability then, as much in a nutshell as we possibly can get a broad topic. But aside from that differential diagnosis around that area post-trauma, would the vestibular systems be something that we'd need to start considering?
I think the vestibular system, frankly, isn't my area of great knowledge, but I think following trauma to head and neck, I think we have to consider that as part of the assessment. And I think increasingly, although it's referred to more within the sensory motor umbrella, I think increasingly we're seeing post whiplash injury that there may be elements of pseudo-vestibular, perhaps, or sensory motor that might require us to add in to the assessment. So I think increasingly we are seeing patients who seem to have some disturbance of all sorts of systems, you know, that may have affected their ability to find their joint position sense, so there are joint position error issues. And again, these things are loosely linked to the vestibular system when you start to look at them, as are some of the visual disturbances that people get after traumas, as is the dizziness that people suffer. So although we always think about pain and focus on pain as therapists, often following traumas, there are other things like dizziness,
yeah,
which one makes us think, oh, is there a red flag? And we've talked about that in a little bit. But when it comes to thinking about dizziness, there are some other systems that we probably should be looking at. And that, for me, would be sensory motor probably and vestibular combined. And within that, there will be elements of needing to look at cranial nerve testing as well. So we have some great vestibular therapists who come here and lecture to the students here, and part of their assessment is a very thorough cranial nerve testing.
And so if we were to think that a presenting patient that is describing some symptoms that are atypical, we would investigate those closer subjectively. We want to make sure we're not going through that recipe-based subjective approach that might miss those things, because otherwise we wouldn't escalate them properly. Is that about right?
I think it is. I think generally patients go in quite a straightforward way, and that's nice, but every now and then you get some that come in with an unusual description of their symptoms, some things that don't fit your textbook as a therapist. You're beginning to wonder, you know, whether they're escalating perhaps in your own mind some of the things that they've got, and then at the same time you should be wondering whether this is something that maybe you don't understand. And I think that was the lesson that I learned with the first guy who walked in with the lower limb problem.
Yeah.
He was describing some things to me that just weren't fitting into my paradigm, and I was thinking, well, is it him or is it me? And that was a great lesson for me in clinical reasoning.
Yeah, and that's a good case there where you've then acted on it and learnt from it. And there are other body parts, other areas in which the hemodynamic system we can learn from stories or learn from experience of others.
Yeah, I mean, we're zooming around the body now, and that's okay, I guess, really, because we're just sort of discussing sort of clinical issues relating to the vascular system. But, I mean, certainly in terms of those early cases that we saw in the lower limb, what it was, and what it was, if you listen to the patient's description, in their cases, they were describing exercise-induced elements to their lower limb problems. And they've been describing that all the way through, in actual fact. But what it was is, because they were young, because they were sporty, And because they didn't have any risk factors for any cardiovascular disease, it wasn't in the clinical reasoning of all of the clinicians. So it was physiotherapists, it was orthopedic surgeons, it was, you know, you name it. They've been to see them, sports medicine specialists, et cetera, et cetera. It wasn't in their index of suspicion that this young, fit man who's in his 20s might have a vascular problem. Because at that time, and I was speaking at the undergraduate conference of sports medicine about a week ago, but at that time there wasn't a great awareness of it. And the conference just over a week ago, it seemed to me that there still isn't an enormous awareness either.
Right.
You know, so some people sort of sat in the audience, you know, sort of thinking, you know, what's this all about? And we were able to show them a series of and often it was case studies and sort of case series just to illustrate that there is more and more of this. And what we have now is a lot of surgical evidence that relates to how these things have been treated and how they've improved with different surgeries over time.
Okay, and so if we think about some more particularly, if we think about in the upper limb, what sports or what actions within those sports would be particularly leading to more vascular problems?
Well, I'll start in the lower limb. I'll come to the upper limb. I'll start in the lower limb because that's logical. It turned out that the many of the problems that these elite athletes were suffering from was relating to cycling, and that's my sport, so that's perhaps why I hooked into it. But it seemed to be linked to acute sort of flexion at the hip, basically. So I think any sports where there is a degree of either repetitive or prolonged flexion at the hip may lead to what's called sort of kinking of the vessels, which probably happens as a normal thing all around the body. But I think if it happens over a long time at high hemodynamic loading, that's where they've been seen to be problems. And what we didn't realize until we started to look into this literature is that some people have more convoluted or tortuous vessels than others. And it seems to be they that are sometimes prone to these problems. So if you happen to have a very convoluted iliac artery, and you then become a top-level cyclist, which involves 120 revolutions per minute for hour after hour after hour, you know, like in the Tour of Italy at the moment, for example, you may be putting your vascular system under stress, and it may lead to sort of some of these problems that tend to lead to the problems called endofibrosis. It relates to fibrosis. It's not atherosclerosis. It's a scarring inside the vessels, which is thought to relate to what they call jet lesions, or almost like a squirting factor within the vessels, which causes the vessels to sort of fibrose and then, as a result, narrow. And that leads to a reduction in blood flow to the sort of distal parts of the limb.
And do they present with these symptoms after very high level exercise, or can it? Does it vary from person to person?
Yeah, most of the information we've got on this is that it affects generally high level athletes. So you're looking at elite athletes, you know, professional or top level amateur. Again, it's rare, but if there was a study done on the Dutch national team a number of years ago where they screened their athletes to see if they were at risk for vascular flow problems, and it turned out that 50% of them did have minor flow problems at that time. And the thing is, with athletes, of course, training generally will involve more loading, and these things may develop over time with certain athletes that have this propensity.
Okay, and did they have, or could we look for certain cues in other areas of the body that might just give us an idea that that might be going on?
Yeah, I think what these things tend to look like is they tend to look like some sort of pseudo-radicular pattern. So we're talking about, with the lower limbs, they seem to look like they could be coming from the back. And so that's the way therapists have pursued the problem over time. But these patients aren't resolving. But if we're listening correctly, we usually ought to be listening and questioning more deeply for this exercise-induced component. And that's what we see in the lower limb. And to be fair, that's commonly what we see in the upper limb, certainly with athletes. So the athletes, some of them come with a set of descriptors that would make you be thinking vascularly if you had that in your sort of clinical reasoning pot in the first place. And it often relates to the sport they do, so throwing sports, javelin, you know, baseball, those sorts of things, depending on where you are, and things like basketball, where the, you know, a lot of arm elevation for, you know, long periods of time. And again, they're reporting, it kind of sounds a little bit like a trap nerve. They might be reporting maybe some sort of weakness. They might be reporting some sort of tingling or pins and needles. And this may, certainly you need to look for the neural system, but if you're not finding anything on your neural testing, then there is an indication to look down the vascular route as well, and maybe put them into some positions that may provoke or reveal any vascular sort of issues.
And it's tricky because the nature of the nervous system and the vascular system is they often track similar paths. And so are there provocative positions for the vascular system that would not provoke the nervous system?
I think there's a lot of controversy over some of the vascular tests. If you look at some of those tests like the Roussy's test, etc., I think the sensitivity and specificity is in question. And you're right about this close proximity of the vascular system and the neural system. But I think if we're in the upper limb and we're looking at the sort of classical upper limb neural tension tests, in actual fact, I don't think anyone has done a study to find out how much that affects the vascular system, and it would be an interesting study to do. So if there's anybody out there thinking about this, you know, that would be a great study to do at undergraduate or master's level or beyond. But I think that's an area that's a good example of how we do something and say, oh yes, this is the neural system, whilst actually we're not entirely sure because we haven't truly tested the vascular system to see what that response is. And my gut feeling here is that it would be an interesting study because you may well find, as you do in testing Roos East, for example, which I've already explained, that there are certain individuals that may be prone to sort of vascular issues with regard to what we think is a neural test.
And that's very tricky, isn't it? That realistically we are going to influence the job lot when we test certain things. But when we get these masqueraders, these potential vascular masqueraders, as we stress the vascular system, and it maybe occludes it slightly to the point where you get a sensory change, people could easily misinterpret that as being a neurological problem.
Yeah, I think it's very tricky, and I think at the end of the day, you know, what keeps those nerves alive is the vascular system, and so, you know, if we're stressing one, we may stress the other, and so you actually might get a neural manifestation. So I think it is hard for clinicians to I think we should be looking for more gross changes. We should be looking, certainly if we're searching for vascular problems, we should be seeing if there's a major change in pulses or a major change in things like blood pressure. And don't forget, we can take blood pressures more distally if we want to, so, you know, you can take blood pressures at the wrist, as well as the brachial artery. You know, we can take blood pressures at the ankle as well as, you know, where we classically do take these things. So there's quite a lot to learn from this vascular stuff, and it's pretty interesting.
And with the pulses, you know, positional pulse taking, say, so we take someone's pulse and then adjust their position, maybe into a sort of sporting function, retest the pulses. Is that something that you'd advocate? Is there any research in that area?
I think the research is sparse. I think if you look in a lot of the textbooks and, again, case studies, you'll be finding people advocating that sort of thing. And from my personal experience, it's something that I would advocate as well. But we have to realise that the reliability of some of these things may not be as good as we might imagine. So I think we can sometimes find things that may or may not be appropriate. And I think what's really important is that we're doing side-to-side, particularly if it's a unilateral, that makes life a lot easier. Side-to-side sort of comparisons, which we'd always do anyway, hopefully. But I think there is some worth in reminding ourselves where the pulses are, where the arteries are, what they should feel like, and that in certain conditions, in certain situations, they may alter. And if that's fitting with a sort of presentation, then it's a consideration for you, and it might be a way for you to further explore it. And the thing with the athletes that have the problems is that often it's not just the position, it's the effort.
Okay.
So what we need to be introducing then is a little bit of an effort test for them. So maybe, you know, because they suffer these things day to day, and it's that they're having it every day with training, it's not a big deal for them to do some exercise in the clinic for you and then for you to look at the pulses. And that's when you often find something a lot more revealing, because at rest we often don't find much change in pulse with most of these folks. But if we exercise them using the exercise that's most applicable to their sport, and then we retest pulses, that's often when we're starting to reveal things.
Okay, so not just positional, it's actually exercise-induced pulse changes.
Exactly, because we're looking for exercise-induced pain, and if we don't induce the exercise and induce the pain, actually, we're unlikely to find the problem.
Fantastic. And one of the most common vascular factors that people will consider throughout practice is DVT. And where does that fit in? And is that something that, I know it's very it's more common in people with vascular risk factors, but does that play a part in sport as well?
Well, yes. I mean, again, looking at all this vascular stuff has just raised our awareness of just how much of this stuff's around. I mean, I was only reading an article last week about the incidence of DVT following knee arthroscopy, which is regularly linked to sport. And it was really, really high. So, the figure, I can't recall off the top of my head, but it was much higher than you would have expected. I think it was close to 40%, but don't quote me on that, although now it's on tape.
I've quoted you.
Yeah, that's it. I'm busted. But no, it's much, much higher than you might have expected. And that was an article in the British Journal of Sports Medicine. I think what we've learned, though, about DVT is that we think, or we were trained perhaps to think of DVT as this sort of classical thing with this big, hot, swollen limb with pitting edema, and it was almost like a no-brainer that someone got a DVT. But in actual fact, the more we've sort of looked into this, the more we've realised that this can happen in a more insidious way, where we're in the early stages, all the patient describes is pain, and like they will report that they feel like they have a calf strain.
Yeah.
And then you go through the history and say, well, you know, what was the reason for the calf strain? And they're a bit puzzled and they can't remember the actual injury, and you're starting to wonder why that was. And then you find out that they've, you know, just flown over from Australia or something prior to the game or whatever they played. So there's a lot of, again, a lot of this stuff is case study stuff, but there's quite a lot of interesting stuff relating to footballers, cricketers, and sometimes it's actually linked to injury. So there's a really interesting case of Steve Waugh, the Australian cricketer, who apparently suffered a calf strain and had some amazing treatment by the Australian therapists that got him back on the pitch, and they won the Ashes, and they flew back to Australia, but then his calf strain came back as they were flying back into Melbourne or Sydney, I don't remember which, and they thought that's a bit strange, and of course they clued in immediately, and because they just had the long haul flight, sent him straight down to the hospital where he had an ultrasound scan, and this time his calf strain was actually a DVT.
Okay.
Whether it was before, we don't know. We don't think so. But it just makes you think, and it makes you question, how did that all work? You know, someone gets a calf strain, he has some incredible treatment, he gets back, he scores 100 and plenty runs, you know, and then he goes on this aeroplane flight, and then he ends up actually with a DVT. So did the DVT come purely as a result of the long-haul flight, nothing to do with the injury, or were there any links between the two?
Of course, yeah, it's hard to tell now, but it's worth raising our eyebrows on and having a think about that.
It's food for thought for us, and I think this has been a journey for us to realise that there's so much that we'd not thought about with regard to the vascular system and how it might link to lots and lots of different things that we see day to day. And I think my message to clinicians would be that many of these people are coming in with some kind of pain syndrome or dysfunction syndrome, and that really, the vascular system is one of the things that you should have in your armoury of clinical reasoning.
So thanks a lot for your time, Alan. And another time, I know me and you are going to get our heads together and talk about the contentious issue of whiplash. But for now, if people want to learn a little bit more about altered hemodynamics and how they could be considering it more in their clinical practice, where would you point them?
Sure. Well, I've put a couple of resources up onto the web. What we've got is, first of all, there's a thing called the Altered Hemodynamics blog, which is alteredhemodynamics.blogspot.co.uk. And there you'll find some of the more straightforward stuff, and you'll find some of the more contentious stuff that we're going to talk about next time, which is the whiplash injury.
Yep.
I've also got a couple of Prezi presentations, which if you searched Google and put Prezi in, which is Prezi, most of you will know that. And then my name, which is Alan, and the J goes in there. I won't tell you what that's for. And Taylor, you should be able to find that via Google. But in there, we've got the Altered Hemodynamics presentation, which is quite nice, and describes how we went from endofibrosis to cervical arterial dysfunction. Then there's some stuff on cervical spine risk assessment and some stuff on cranial nerves and some probably old stuff now on whiplash injury. I'll probably have to take that down.
No problem. Well, I can easily make those things available to our listeners on the show notes. And I thank you very much again. And look forward to speaking to you again soon.
Thanks very much, Jack. That's been really good.
And there we have session 8. Many thanks to Alan, as with all of our guests, very generous with his time, offering his insights into things for us. We did mention a podcast with Roger Kerry, his partner in crime, which was with Australian physiotherapist David Pope on the Physio Edge podcast, our Australian equivalent, if you like. So definitely check that out. Can highly recommend Roger's and other podcasts on that stream. As I mentioned at the top of the show, Alan's been involved in a little bit of controversy on the discussion in and around some blogs involving whiplash recently, which I can point you into the direction of. I'm sure he'd be keen for people to have a little look at what's been out there recently. So that'll be on the show notes, of course. The reason, again, I mention it, and I mentioned it at the start, is because if you read between the lines of the discussion in the chat we had, you should maybe be able to realise how being a consultant of complex vascular cases that Alan has been for many years, and having seen patients that have been mismanaged or misguided due to a degree of almost complacency by some that work within a biopsychosocial framework, would be somewhat frustrating. In my opinion, modern pain science needn't distract us from fundamental clinical reasoning. It should inform it and it should promote it. There is a bit of a concern amongst many, and myself included to some degree, that the pendulum might be swinging too far in a direction away from frontline patient care. In our interview today, and off the microphone, Alan mentions occasions where patients with chronic symptoms have been treated with manual therapy, core stability exercises, CBT, multidisciplinary rehab courses, usually in that order almost, only to eventually discover that vascular surgery cures them instantly. And I'd argue that'd be because their brain's danger alarm, that is pain, was right all along. And sometimes it is, so we can't forget that. I know some would argue that that sort of practice is very rare. However, just from off the back of my conversation with Alan, I did discuss it with some colleagues of mine that work under the biopsychosocial framework in pain clinics with as chronic pain specialists. And as I asked them on those sorts of occasions, why it is that patient might have gone down that path, and why they then resolved so well afterwards. They then provoked the conversation that it may well be that their expectance of surgery was enough to then resolve things, and it could well have not been a structural or vascular issue in the end. A little bit cynical, I think, from them, considering that a lot of these patients, as Alan mentioned, had fasciotomies, etc., that didn't solve it. Many passive interventions that didn't solve their problem. I think it is a little naive. However, it's really healthy to debate these things amongst ourselves, and that's what the Physio Matters podcast is all about. So I really thank you for listening. Hope it's been interesting for you, and I look forward to speaking to you on a new episode very shortly. So all that's left for me to do is hand you back over to Alan for him to sign us out with the real reason that you listen to these podcasts, I know. Bye from me for now.
Well, folks, you've been listening to the Physio Matters podcast, discussing Physio Matters, because you know it, Physio Matters.